studying just this verse. Now we're going to move on to the next part, but I'm going to just do a basic background to it. All about the issue I said about people dying before the coming of Christ. So what I need to do as background to that, and I'd like to do it today so that I can keep up to finishing on time next week, I'd like to do with you the background of what did Jewish people think about the resurrection at this time. What is the background against which we need to look to understand this text? I've got four pages for you only, and I'll just read them through very simply. The first thing to know is that Jewish people at the time of Jesus, or go back to the Bible, prior to Jesus, through the Bible, the first thing they thought was the dead, when you die, you go down into the grave, into the pit, and you go down into the, wherever it was, Hades it's called by the Greek, Sheol by the Hebrews, into this lifeless existence somewhere down there in the middle of the earth, and you're a shadow, you're not a human being. All right, that's the normal belief. I'll give you some texts. Psalm 88, 3-5 reads, "My soul is full of troubles, my life draws near to Sheol." Person's about to die. "I'm counted among those who go down to the pit. I'm like those who have no help, like the forsaken among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they're cut off from your hand." Do you see? They thought death was the end. When you die, you're cut off from God's hand. God doesn't remember them anymore. They're forgotten even by God. That's the end. Not the end of existence, but the end of life. Psalm 115, verse 17. "The dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any that go down into silence." Isaiah chapter 38. "Sheol cannot thank you, death cannot praise you. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. The living, they thank you. Fathers, make known your faithfulness." See, are you following me? That was the general understanding of the Jews a little bit before Jesus' time. And the Greeks, and the Romans, the Egyptians were quite exceptional with their mummies and their sense of afterlife and so on. But generally this was the way. And lastly, the book of Sirach, written only 200 years before Jesus. Chapter 17 says, "Who will sing praises to the Most High in Hades in place of the living who give thanks? From the dead, as from one who doesn't exist, thanksgiving has ceased. Those who are alive and well sing the Lord's praises." So there's our first point. However, the second point is that while they assumed that death was the end of life, they did have this longing for an enduring relationship with God. Excuse me, and we find this, for example, in these Psalms, Psalm 16. So it's a longing, but they thought the longing would be frustrated. They didn't dream it would be fulfilled. They thought the longing would go, and then they'd die, and then that's it. And here's the longing. Psalm 16, "My heart is glad, my soul rejoices, my body also rests secure. For you do not give me up to Sheol. You do not let your faithful one see the pit." In other words, God is keeping me alive. "You show me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. In your right hand pleasures forever." But as you read that text, you can see, understood, while I'm here alive and you're keeping me alive and I hope to live to a ripe old age and have kids and grandkids and everything like that. Psalm 99, "God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. He will receive me." That didn't mean I'm going to rise to life after death. It meant God's going to stop me from dying, rescue me from the pit. Psalm 73. But there's still the longing, isn't there, for a constant communion with God. Nevertheless, I'm continually with you, Psalm 73. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterwards you receive me with honor. Whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. I'm sure you can feel there a kind of longing, a confusion. I'm not saying they were all certain. They're like us, but we've got another thing. They assume that death is the end, but they're hoping beyond it too, and longing for God. The third point that we come to, and there are only four in this background, is that even in the exile in Babylon, so the year 500 BC, 520, something like that, 550, in that second half of the 6th century before Christ, if later you wanted to read Ezekiel 37, 1 to 14, it's about the dry bones and the Spirit of God going in the dry bones and they rise up. If you read Isaiah chapter 53, verses 8 to 12, it's also relevant, and had I time I'd read it for you now, but it shows you the beginnings of another way of looking at things, and a hope of life beyond death too, in a way. And there's this post-exilic text, Isaiah 26, so written probably about the year 400 and something. It reads, "The dead do not live, shades do not rise, because you've punished and destroyed them and wiped out all their memory." And then the verse 19 of Isaiah 26 says, your dead, the dead of those who are faithful to God, your dead shall live. Their corpses shall rise. It's the beginnings of some further insight here. Oh, dwellers in the dust, that means you who in the graves, awake, sing for joy, for your dew is a radiant dew. The dew brings life. And the earth will give birth to those long dead. Extraordinary text. Right out of the blue, really. In Isaiah 26. Very, very clearly the beginnings of hope. A dream, maybe. But not a common one. Then comes, and now we're in for quite a dramatic shift. Then comes the year 168. The period when the Seleucid Empire from Antioch in Syria, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, he called himself Epiphanes, which means the radiance of God radiates out of him, so he had a pretty big ego, I'd say. And he's Antiochus IV, anyhow. He came down to Jerusalem, walked into the temple, and placed a statue of Zeus. It was a Eastern equivalent. Baal Shamem it was, the Baal, the Lord of the heavens, Shamem. He placed it, but it was Zeus, on the Holy of Holies. And Jesus calls that in the New Testament the abomination of desolation, following on from Daniel. So this terrible sacrilege in the Holy of Holies barged through, tore the curtain up and put that statue there, and that started the Maccabees. The priest with his seven sons went off into the hills and started the first guerrilla warfare that we've got any written documentation about from the Maccabees. Well, at that time, because in the martyrdom, innocent young people were being murdered by the Syrians, Jews, and people thought, well, it couldn't be a punishment of God, you know. I mean, they're innocent, they're beautiful, great heroic people, the mother of the Maccabees, you've read that maybe, and the these wonderful saints were being murdered, and it kind of broke into consciousness, that's the best way to put it, that death can't be the end, not from any philosophical argument, but because God is God. God is love, and if you give love, parents don't want to see the tragedy, and some of you may have had it, you know, of a mother or father when your child dies before you. I just can't even imagine that, but it must be one of the most painful things that can happen to any parent. and it's kind of wrong, you know, like parents are meant to die before their children, and yet it's all that terrible pain. You parents, you gave life, you don't want to take it away. Well, God doesn't either. So it broke into consciousness that there must be something beyond death. And you find evidence of it in Daniel, written at the time, Daniel chapter 12, and the second book of Maccabees, also written in this second century before Christ. I'll just read them both to you. At that time your people shall be delivered. Everyone who's written in the book of life, God, remember. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to eternal life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. It's the oldest biblical statement we have, right at the end of the Old Testament, where we see the idea of reward and punishment after death, when we live again. 2 Maccabees chapter 7, the whole chapter is worth reading, but just verse 36. Our brothers, these are the seven boys of the mother of the Maccabees, our brothers, after enduring a brief suffering, have drunk of ever-flowing life under God's covenant. By the judgment of God, you will receive just punishment for your arrogance. Statement made against the Syrian overlords. So we have the beginnings of a belief in the resurrection of the dead. And that becomes the opinion that is held by the Pharisees at the time of Jesus, and the Sadducees didn't. And in the New Testament you'll find evidence that the Sadducees were against the idea, the Pharisees were for it. So it was a debated question at the period of Jesus. Do we have life after death or don't we? Let's look at the way this belief was expressed, and then I'll leave you for your reading next. Firstly, one of the images that is in the Bible for what it means to be alive after death with God is Enoch. A curious story, right back in the book of Genesis, talks about Enoch walking with God, and then he was no more because God took him. And Hebrews, that's the New Testament letter, or it's actually a sermon, oration, chapter 11 verse 5, talking about Enoch, says he did not experience death. So it's what we call an assumption, taken up alive to God, not dead, however they imagined it, but that's how they were thinking. Elijah too has the same extraordinary image. Elijah was ascended in a whirlwind into heaven. So they had this picture, which helped their imagination, of Elijah being still alive in heaven. And then, do you remember, there was the legend then that he would come back again when the Messiah came. And Jesus talks about John the Baptist being the one who fulfilled that dream. But it's a funny folklore-y image, but that was there, and you might as well know it in your mind. Assumed somehow up into the mystery of heaven, which they thought was up there. Popular legend led to other famous people being thought of as having been taken up into heaven without dying. Now, they were obviously exceptional. The Book of Wisdom, written at just at the beginning of the first century AD, about the time when Jesus was alive, chapter 4, verse 10 to 11, written in Alexandria by Jewish writers. There were some who pleased God and were loved by him, and while living among sinners, they were taken up. They were caught up so that evil mightn't change their understanding or guile deceive their souls. And some of that imagery you find in Paul, about being wrapped up, caught up into the heavens, and we'll see them next week. So, to conclude, Paul the Pharisee, and the Pharisees believed in the resurrection of the dead, the Sadducees didn't. Paul would have been trained in this idea from Gamaliel. So Paul the Pharisee, who had become a follower of Jesus, proclaimed that God had already raised Jesus to life. Of course, after death. And taken Jesus into glory as the first fruits of those who would believe in him. Jesus, in other words, had destroyed death. They had come to see through Jesus that death does not end life. It doesn't put, because life is communion with God. Life goes on, but death is simply the breakdown of what we now know as our body now. but it doesn't end our life. He would come and gather up his disciples to share his glory. The dominant image seems to have been that of Enoch and Elijah, as far as I can gather reading Paul. That was his initial dominant expectation. And Christians hope that God would come and sweep them up into life with Jesus without having to die. It sounds very strange to us, but in the light of what I've given you, I hope it's not too strange to imagine them imagining that. So this is their problem. If that is your image, and you're in a community, and Christianity and the first fruits and the resurrection of Jesus all made you very expectant, if somebody in the community dies, well, what happens? You get a shock. You think, oh, something's gone wrong. So what would happen to their Christian brothers and sisters who died? That was their question that they asked Timothy about, and Timothy asks Paul about, and Paul's about to answer. When Jesus came, and they expected it to be soon, and gathered the living up into glory, would the dead remain dead? Would they be separated from the rest of the community, awaiting the general resurrection? When death came and gathered the living to glory, what would happen to the dead? Would they be separated from the rest of the community, awaiting the general resurrection? Or would God do to them what he did to Jesus and bring them back to life and take them up into glory? They're wondering what's going to happen. It's a simple question. We all would have had it. Paul will answer it as best he can within his own frame of reference in chapter 4, verse 13 and the following, which